Okay, so I'd like to just finish the thought that I was on at the end of the first lecture, which is that this observation about the class of definable sets being that if we take a projection, if we take an existential quantifier applied to a formula, that gives us a projection. So what this says is if we look at the definable sets as a class, we have a class of sets which is closed under union and intersection and complement and also under projection. So it's a nice class of sets. And where this becomes useful is when we will have a particular a class of sets that we're interested in mathematically from some point of view. If we can choose our language so that that class of sets is the class of definable sets, then we have a chance of addressing it model theoretically. And then if furthermore we know something about the theory that we're interested in or about all the structures that we're looking at, which tells us something about what kind of formulas we have or what kind of formulas are relevant in a way, then that tells us a lot about the definable sets. And that's really the way in which model theory can get can have all these applications in lots of different areas. So that's what we'll kind of be heading towards in this lecture and then in the examples in the next lecture. All right, so that was one thought from the first lecture. And the other one, which I didn't quite have time to finish, is the reason why we look at first-order logic, why we focus on first-order logic and don't allow quantifiers over subsets of the universe, and that is the completeness theorem. And so the completeness theorem says if I fix a language and take some theory, so then a theory T is satisfiable. And remember, I defined satisfiable to mean to have a model, so it has a model. If and only if T is consistent, which means does not prove a contradiction. Now, what I haven't said what it means for a theory to prove something, and I don't want to, because I want to focus on the model theory. And so I'm not going to define what this means to prove a contradiction. In particular, I'm not going to prove the completeness theorem. But whatever proof is, it certainly has to be a finite object. It's some way of, from the theory, deducing through some finite number of steps using rules of deduction that you're allowed to use, something which would turn out to be a contradiction or not being able to prove a contradiction. And the reason why I state the compactness theorem, even though I'm not going to even say what it means to prove something, the completeness theorem, is that I want to get out of it the compactness theorem. And the compactness theorem is kind of absolutely fundamental to model theory, and we use it all the time, and it has lots of really rather beautiful consequences. So I really need to have the compactness theorem. And the compactness theorem says that a theory is satisfiable, so it has a model, if and only if it is finitely satisfiable. And finitely satisfiable means every finite subset of it has a model. So the compactness theorem, one can prove it directly. Yes?
Is this theorem constructive in a sense that it can build a model?
No. All right, yeah. And that's why, of course, whenever we use the compactness theorem in model theory to get out some other nice result, it's non-constructive. In fact, sort of one of the ways we use the compactness theorem most often, certainly in omentumality, is to say if you have a family of sets which say is bounded, then we can say by the compactness theorem that it's bounded as you change a parameter, then it's uniformly bounded. That is, there's a fixed bound as you range over the parameter. And we'll always prove that using the compactness theorem, and it doesn't tell you how to find the bound. So that's kind of the fundamental question. But what's a nice thing to do is to go back into the proof of the compactness theorem to try to get that bound, to try to make it constructive instead. It's actually for people who are working on that in various ways, doing that kind of thing. So we can get the compactness theorem from the completeness theorem very easily. I think it's pretty obvious. Okay, so one direction is immediate. So the other direction, so okay, maybe I'll write something down. So for the non-trivial direction, if I suppose my theory, suppose not, so I'll suppose my theory is finitely satisfiable but not satisfiable. So then by the completeness theorem, it's not consistent. So it must prove a contradiction. And I said that whatever a proof is, it's certainly a finite object. So a finite proof can only call on finitely many of the sentences in T. So that means that a finite subset of T proves a contradiction, but then by the completeness theorem again, that finite subset is not satisfiable. So finite subset S of T proves a contradiction, so by completeness again, S is not satisfiable, but that's a contradiction with our hypothesis. So it follows very easily from the completeness theorem. Of course, we still have to prove the completeness theorem, which is where all the work is, or prove it directly. But it's for this reason that we use first-order logic, because we get this theorem. Okay, so now that takes me to lecture two. And so far what I've done is mostly to set up our kind of our language, our structures, what the kinds of objects are that we're talking about. And now what I want to do is to focus more on relations between structures. So if it, say, fix a language and look at a bunch of different structures in that language, then what kind of connections are there between them? And, of course, the first and most fundamental one is to be a substructure. And I want to talk a little bit more about that idea. It seems a very straightforward idea, so why belabor the point? But let me just say a little bit more about it. So let's suppose I have M. So M is a structure with universe M in this language L. N is a structure with universe N in the same language L. And let me assume that M is a substructure of N. So the universe, so M is a subset of N, and all the symbols of the language are interpreted in the same way. So when we say that, that means that if I take, so let me fix sort of A and B elements of the set M. When I say that the symbols are interpreted in the same way, that means that if I look at some function symbol and look at the way it's interpreted in M, and if at this element A it takes the value B, so if in M it's true that the function evaluated at A is equal to B, then this has to be true in N as well. Then the function evaluated in N at A has to be equal to B. That's just what it's saying. The function symbols are interpreted in the same way. If I take a relation symbol and interpret it take its interpretation in N, and it says that some relation holds of A or holds of A and B or whatever it is, then it has to be the same thing. It has to be true in N. So if I keep applying this recursively according to the way that terms are written, it says if I take any two terms and if I look at them, if M says that two terms evaluate to be the same thing, Well, then Ed has to say that too. Well, this is an if and only if. The same things, the terms have to evaluate in the same way. If I take in any atomic formula, so if I take a relation and apply it to a term, the same thing will be true. So if phi is atomic, and if M says something, says that phi holds for some element A, then N will have to say it as well. And if I take logical connectives between atomic formulae, then the same thing is true. So what all this is saying is if I take not just phi atomic, but if I take any phi, any formula without quantifiers, any quantifier-free formula, and it's also saying it not just about for any element A in the set M. So I can also say that if this is really saying something stronger, I'm working not just in the language L, I'm working in the language with parameters for M, for everything in M, because I can talk about everything in M when I want to say, is something holding at a particular element. So it's actually a very strong statement to say that something's a substructure. It says that if you take any quantifier-free sentence, which is true, if I take any quantifier-free formula, which is true for some particular element of the smaller set, then it's true in the larger set, in the larger structure as well. Of course, this is not true as soon as I put on quantifiers. And so if I put on a quantifier, so if the smaller structure, say, says that for all x, phi of x, then of course this means that no matter what x I put in as an element of M, so then what this says is that in M, it's true that phi of A holds for every A in M. So it's also true in N. So N also says that phi of A holds for every A in M, but it doesn't say for every A in N. Right? So if I have a universal statement which is true in M, the property that we're talking about is certainly going to be true in N for everything in M, but not for everything in N. So N does not tell us that for all X, phi of X. I mean, we don't know. It doesn't have to say. The existential quantifier goes up. All right. So what this? But of course, if I turn it around, if I knew that the universal were true in N, it would be true in M. All right. So, in other words, what I'm saying is that the universal goes down, and the existential goes up. Okay, so the kinds of things which we know, which we will know to be true, just because of that substructure property, which seemed like it was quite weak, but it actually is telling us a lot. So just, again, to be kind of very concrete, if I look at, say, the reals in the language of rings, or versus the rationals in the language of rings, and if I take a particular term, which is a polynomial, say, with coefficients in the rationals, then If in the rationals it's true that this particular polynomial with rational coefficients is equal to zero, which is something I can say about the rationals, then it will be true also. It's true both ways. This is an if and only if. All right, the reals will say that particular polynomial is equal to zero. I guess I don't want the x here. All right, I'm saying that, well, at particular a. Let's make that sort of precise. Okay, so if where Q and A are both rationals, all right? So if the reals tell us that this polynomial is equal to zero at this particular rational number, then the rationals will tell us that too. But if the reals tell us that there exists a root to that particular polynomial, the rationals won't tell us that. Now, of course, this is obvious and clear, but this is the fact that it's a substructure, that Q is a substructure of R, is telling us, is communicating this information as well, just to say that it's a substructure. All right, but now sometimes we get a stronger property. And so sometimes it's true that all formulas, in fact, the truth of a formula in one structure tells us about the truth of the formula in the other structure. And if that happens, then we call it an elementary substructure. So we say that M is an elementary substructure if elementary substructure of N, and I'll write M curly less than or equal to N, okay, so elementary substructure, if for every formula five X and every possible way of putting a value to X from the universe of the smaller model, so for every M and M, then the formula is true in M if and only if it's true in M. Okay, so we have this much stronger property, which the definition is to be an elementary substructure. So the example over there tells us that the rationals, again, you know, in the language of rings or ordered rings, is not an elementary substructure. It's a substructure, but not an elementary substructure of the reals. And if I want to find an elementary substructure, then I have to go to something bigger, like the real algebraic numbers. So the real algebraic numbers in the same language will be an elementary substructure of the reals. Okay, so that's something that would have to be proved, but this example also tells us that doesn't tell us that yet because I haven't defined it yet. So then the other thing that we want to define, we say that a theory T is model complete if for every pair of models M and N, which are models of the theory, if M is a substructure of N, then M is an elementary substructure of N. Okay, so that then is a very strong property that we're asking on a theory. We're saying if I take any two models of the theory, so anything, any structures in which every sentence in the theory is true, and suppose that one is a substructure of the other, then in fact it's an elementary substructure. So every formula which is true in one structure is true in the other substructure. So this example tells us I have Q and R, which are certainly both models of the theory of fields, and one's a substructure of the other, but not an elementary substructure. So the theory of fields is not model complete. However, if I add some more to that theory and ask more of it, we can define the theory of real closed fields, and that theory is model complete. The theory of real closed fields . Now I want to talk more about the theory of real closed fields, and I really kind of want to push that on to the next lecture, where I'll talk about how we can prove this theorem. But let's just say for the moment that if a theory, a field is real closed if it can be ordered, so I can put an ordering on it in some way, and every positive element has a square root, and every odd degree polynomial has a root. Okay, so that gives us the theory of real closed fields. And so that's why I had to go up here to the real algebraic numbers, because it's because of this theorem, maybe we can say it that way around, that I get this statement, that the real algebraic numbers gives me an elementary substructure of the real numbers. So what I'd like to do now is to give you an example of the power of model completeness and how it gives us a really nice kind of elegant proofs of statements. So we can use this theorem, that the theory of real closed fields is model complete, and the property of model completeness to write down a very quick proof of the solution to Hilbert's 17th problem. So let's do that. So the theorem says, let's take a positive definite polynomial over the reals, so take a polynomial with real coefficients, I'll call the variable t, just not to confuse it with x's, which we use for something else, the polynomial such that for all t in R to the n, f of t is greater than or equal to 0. Then, and so Hilbert asked the question, is it true that such a polynomial can be written as a sum of squares of rational function? And the answer is yes. Then there exist rational functions g1 of t to gk of t in R of X, such that f of t is the sum of the g sub I of t squared. Okay, so it's asking whether the functional property of f of always being positive is revealed in some way by its algebraic expression. So the proof, suppose not. So suppose there are no rational functions with the property that f can be written as a sum of squares of those rational functions. What that then says is if we look at the field R of t, the field of rational functions as a field, I can put an ordering on that field in such a way that f is a negative element. Right? So then there is an ordering, which I'll call it less than star, just to make quite clear this is something that we're defining here. There's an ordering less than star on the field of rational functions, which extends the ordering on R. But so that in this ordering, F as an element of the field is negative. And for this, we need to know something about the theory of orderings on a real field. And so there's some algebra to be done there in order to get that statement. Okay, so if I take now this field R of t with this ordering, it's a model for the theory of fields with an ordering, and it's not a real closed field, right? It doesn't satisfy the property that every positive element has a square root, like for example, t if it's positive doesn't have a square root. But I can extend it to a real closed field, so I can be extended to a real closed field L. So I just get a bigger field, I put in all the algebraic extensions, I extend the ordering in the way that's necessary, and then I have a real closed field. And in this real closed field, the following sentence is true. So L is a model for the statement there exists an X such that F at X is less than zero. Okay, so because if I just by taking X to be just the element T, which is an element of the field, of the rational function field R of T. Now it's important here to think that, well, what is this saying? F as is given as a polynomial with real coefficients, but it's I can think of it as being a term. It's a term in some indeterminate, in a variable X. And then when I substitute T into that term, then I'm just taking the expression, which is the polynomial F, written out. And so in this field, it's true, because it's true in R of T, that this element is less than zero. That's the way that was what we knew about the ordering less than star. But now we know that the L is a real closed field, and the theory of real closed fields is model complete. So we know that this formula, this sentence, also has to be true back downstairs in R itself. So by model completeness, R also has to say that there exists an X such that F of X is less than, and less than is now the regular usual ordering on R, is less than zero. But that's a contradiction, because that's contradicts my assumption on F. So we need to know two things about real closed fields, one of which is that any ordered field can be extended to a real closed field, and the other is this algebraic property about if something's not a sum of squares, then I can put an ordering on in which that element is negative. But then the model completeness the result just drops out very, very nicely. Okay, so model completeness is very closely related to another property which theories might have, which is called quantifier elimination. And I want to state a definition for quantifier elimination, which is not the standard definition. Let me go over here. I'll leave that up a little bit. Here's a good place. It's not the standard definition of model of quantifier elimination, but I want to say it this way because it gives us a sense of how close quantifier elimination is to the property of model completeness. And then I'll rewrite it in terms of the more standard terms, but then again, we can see model completeness in a similar way. So let me assume I'm working with a complete theory T in a language with at least one constant symbol. And I'm just throwing that in for technical reasons to make sure I'm not saying anything wrong. We don't really need to worry about it, and besides, we're really interested in the theory of fields where we do have at least one constant symbol. In fact, we have two, so it's not an issue. So let me just state again what it means to be model complete. And I said that, so model completeness, every substructure is an elementary substructure. But let's just rewrite that in terms of formulae. So model completeness says if I take any two models of the theory, and I suppose that M is a substructure of N, then for any formula phi of X, and for any M in the set capital M, if M satisfies, M satisfies phi of M if and only if N satisfies phi of M. Okay, so that's just restating by naming a formula phi what it means to be an elementary substructure. So then we can say that the theory has quantifier elimination if, okay, start the same way, let M and N be any models of T, and A a common substructure. So I take a subset A of M intersect N. The set for A is in both of them, and the interpretation of the symbols is the same. So from M to N, either M to N going down to A, I interpret the symbols in the same way. Then for any formula, phi of x, and any element little a in capital A, we have that M satisfies phi of A if and only if N satisfies phi of A. So the difference between the two is a little subtle, right? But the quantifier elimination statement is stronger because certainly if I have the statement of quantifier elimination, then if I simply take A to be a substructure of M, then I have the same result. So it's kind of, but this, it almost looks the same because it's still saying that I think any formula is true in one structure if and only if it's true in the other structure. So I'd like to just run through an example of how these statements differ. And then I'll go back and explain why we call it quantifier elimination, which is not evident from the way I said it. So let's look at the field again. The rational function field, the function field of functions of rational functions over the reals, which I have an ordering on the reals. I can extend that ordering to the rational functions in lots of different ways. So I could choose two different ways of extending it. So I'll take one extension of the ordering in which I make the element t positive. So less than 1 is an ordering on R of t for which t is positive. Or on the other hand, I can take an ordering less than 2 for which t is negative. Okay, so then I can take, I can now extend f, this rational function field, by adjoining a square root of t, and let me call that f1. So that's f adjoin a square root of t. T is positive, so it's reasonable to add a square root, and this will be a field which it's still consistent to put an ordering on. Or alternatively, I can put in a square root of minus t, in this case, because I've made t negative, so it makes sense to add a square root of minus t. And in either case, I can then extend it to a real closed field, extending F1, and F2 tilde will be the real closed field over here. So if I want to think about the theory of real closed fields, and I want to say show that it's model complete, then these are examples of fields that I have to look at. Well, I mean, if I want to look at the condition, I'm taking T to be the theory of real closed fields. To test for model completeness, I have to take two models of which one is a substructure of the other. So I would have to consider here the models R, which is a real closed field, and F1 tilde. It's a substructure of F1 tilde. R is also a substructure of F2 tilde. And so I have to look at the condition and think about, is it true? But if I want to talk about quantifier elimination, I can't just look at F1 tilde and F2 tilde separately. I have to look at both of them. I have to look at this F1 tilde and F2 tilde. But what I... My issue is that I have to say, well, what does it mean to be a common substructure? Now, the way I've set it up here, in fact, not just R, but R of T is a common substructure of both F1 tilde and F2 tilde. But a formula that I might talk about in R of T is the formula which says phi could be the formula. Yes, so I was very careful. I said the theory of real closed fields, and I should have been a little bit more specific. When I write down the theory of real closed fields, I don't include the symbol less than in my language. This is in the language of rings. All right, now I can write down the theory of real closed fields without actually talking explicitly about the ordering. I don't need the ordering in order to say that a field is real closed. I didn't say that write down the axioms for real closed fields, so I can't say that explicitly right now. But I don't need to talk about the ordering. I can get around it. I can always refer to the ordering using a quantifier. All right, so in fact, x is less than y, just in case y minus x is positive, just in case y minus x has a square root. So instead of saying y minus x is positive, I would always say has a square root. And so I can get around that. So in the language of rings, I do have a substructure here. And so it becomes an issue. It's exactly that issue, because I have different orderings, but I didn't talk about the ordering, so it's a substructure. So in the language of rings, I have to address this substructure. And so it turns out this property is not true, exactly because I can write down a sentence which says, which basically says T has a square root, which is true in this one, in F1 tilde, and not true in F2 tilde. So the formula which says T has a square root will give me a counterexample to the criterion for testing quantifier elimination. If I add the symbol to the language, so in the language, with the ordering put in there, then my condition, which says that this symbol has to be interpreted in the same way, exactly says that R of T is not simultaneously a substructure of both of those. R of T is not a substructure. Of both, I mean, not simultaneously a substructure of both of them. Okay, I can interpret the symbol in one way, and that makes it a substructure of F1 tilde. I interpret the symbol in a different way, that makes it a substructure of F2 tilde. But it's not simultaneously a substructure of both of them, so I don't have to look at that statement which says that T has a square root when I try to test for quantifier elimination. So then it's no longer a counterexample, because I can't, remember, I have to look at a formula and then look at any, sort of look at that formula when it's saying something about the substructure A. So the particular formula, T has a square root, is not a formula which I can say about R, for example, because T is not an element of R. So when I'm trying to discuss quantifier elimination in the language of ordered rings, then I have to go all the way down to R in order to get a common substructure of both of these fields. And then there are fewer things that I can say, so fewer formulae that I have to consider. So kind of the example is trying to show you is the importance of the language that we consider and the difference between the two, kind of what's the strength of the criterion that we have to look at. And somehow this point about the substructures is being, we need to know what substructures are of a given model in order to look at points like questions like quantifier elimination or model completeness. Okay, so let me restate the definition of model completeness and quantifier elimination in a more syntactic form. I'll think of this as being a model theoretic test, and then I'll take a syntactic version. Yes.
I don't know very much what the sentence.
That, sorry, I didn't write it down. So. Well, let me say there exists an x such that x squared is equal to t. All right. So this is a formula. It's a sentence which involves the parameter t from the structure R of t. So F1 tilde says that phi is true, right? T has a square root. And F2 tilde says that not phi is true.
So you permit the formulas with parameters in the set?
In the set A. Yes. So here, see, T is in an element of R of T. Well, I don't think I actually do have to. All right, so just looking at the statement here, it says that for any formula with a variable, if that formula is true with the value of the variable being substituted for that element of the structure, I guess I have to make t. I have to make it a constant. I put in a constant for. What I really do is to take the language with constants for all the elements of A, and then look at all of those formulae and compare them in the two structures. Okay, so I'll state this as a theorem, but it could also be thought of as a definition. So first of all, the theory, T, a complete theory. And a language with at least one constant symbol. So then T is model complete. If for any L formula, phi of x, there is a quantifier free . So that just means a formula which is written down without any quantifiers. Quantifier-free formula psi of xy such that for all models of t, it's true in M that for all x, psi of x, if and only if there exists a y, such that psi of xy. So model completeness says that any formula is equivalent in all models of the theory to a formula with one existential quantifier. And quantifier elimination says T, let's say T has quantifier elimination. If for any L formula phi of x, there is a quantifier-free formula theta of x such that for all models of the theory, it's true in M, oh, this is a board that doesn't say it. It's true in M that for all X, phi of X is and only if theta of X. So quantifier elimination says that every formula is equivalent in all models of the theory to a quantifier-free formula. That's why it's called quantifier elimination. So I'd like to prove the theorem for the quantifier elimination part, and we can get it more easily for the model complete part, but I don't think I have time today, so I'm going to do that next time. But what I'd like to say today is what in particular this statement of what it means to be model complete and have quantifier elimination says about the class of definable sets in a structure. So this syntactic version is nice because we can use it to understand what the formulae in a structure look like. The model theoretic version is nice because it gives us a good ways of proving quantifier elimination. Here, to prove it this way, we have to go through and eliminate the quantifier, whereas it's nice not to have to do that. That tends to be a little more grungy. So what does it say in terms of the geometry of definable sets? If I have model completeness, then, okay, so let me take a set which is defined by a formula, the set of X and M, such that phi of X holds. If I have model completeness, then I know that phi of X is equivalent to there exists y such that psi of x y, and so this tells me that x, therefore, I can define it using this formula instead, and so since this formula has an existential quantifier, it's a projection. So x is a projection of a quantifier-free definable set. So what I'll talk about later on is that the theory of the reals with function symbols added for restricted analytic functions, and this is called Rn, we put in a load of function symbols for all of the restricted analytic functions, and we'll see that the theory, in this case, is model complete. So the theory of Rn is model complete. So what this tells us is that if I look at the quantifier-free definable sets, well, if I have a language with all these analytic functions put in, then the kinds of things I can say in a quantifier-free way are that some term built out of these function symbols, these restricted analytic functions, is equal to zero, or it's less than zero, or is less than some other term. And so essentially what I can define, the quantifier-free definable sets, are the semi-analytic sets. And then the projections of the semi-analytic sets, so the projections of the quantifier-free definable sets, are essentially the sub-analytic sets. So the projections are sub-analytic sets. And so the theorem, which says that every definable set is the projection of a quantifier-free definable set, says that every definable set is sub-analytic, and that in particular tells us that if I take the complement of a subanalytic set, it's also a definable set, and so the complement is also subanalytic. So the complement of subanalytic is also subanalytic. So So this is a monotheoretic way of talking about Gabriella's theorem of the complement. Now, if I have a theory which has quantifier elimination, so not just model completeness, but quantifier elimination, then when I take this, when I do this step, the definable sets are just quantifier-free definable. So I get a stronger statement. So we'll see that the theory of the reals in the language of ordered rings has quantifier elimination. And in this case, the definable sets are all quantifier-free definable. Now, in this case, so the quantifier-free definable sets in the reals with just the language of ordered rings are the things that we can talk about are polynomials, and the things we can say about them are that they're equal to zero or that they're less than or equal to zero. So the quantifier-free definable sets are the semi-algebraic sets. Quantifier-free definable is semi-algebraic. And so if I take any definable set, if I take projections of, in particular, of semi-algebraic sets, then they're still semi-algebraic. So projections of semi-algebraic sets are semi-algebraic. So I guess that's a model theoretic way of talking about Zeidenberg's theorem. And so what I want to do next time, I'll stop now, but what I'll do next time is to prove the theorem of the equivalence of those two definitions of quantifier elimination, and then I'll talk about how we can prove that the reals have quantifier elimination. Are there any questions? All right, then let's have lunch.